Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Trying to decipher the housing market can be a challenge. There are just so many variables you have to consider. Prices, inventories, construction figures, total sales, you get the picture. So today, when some of those numbers were bad, but others were good, you started hearing faint whispers of hope, wondering whether the bottom might finally be in sight. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's the 26th of August. And let me take a second right at the start here to point out that you can only know a market has hit bottom after the bounce back up has already started. So there's a case to be made that all the experts out there who are whispering the word bottom are taking something of a leap of faith. It's a leap grounded mostly in this fact, revealed in a couple of key surveys out today, that the rate of decline in some important indicators, like sales and prices, seems to have slowed. Add a rise in consumer confidence and a rally in the dollar that looks like it's holding, and that was enough to make for a generally positive economic mood. But listen, do you remember the credit markets, arguably the source of much of our trouble? Poke around in there, and not everybody likes what they find. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite has more.
Today's economic news may sound positive, but market watchers say it doesn't add up to a trend. Diane Vaza heads global fixed income research at Standard & Poor's. She says what does make a trend is financial services companies' reluctance to lend money. They're jacking up their rates to shield themselves in case borrowers can't repay, which she says could well happen.
The credit markets really have at least another 18 months of, you know, fairly gut-wrenching problems to work out. We're expecting that there will be a bottom in the recession in first quarter 2009.
The financial sector's health is key to the wider economy's recovery, says Marilyn Cohen of Envision Capital Management. She says financial firms need to come clean about their debt.
I will be very, very leery until we see the write-downs and the write-offs start to decline. And not an announcement by one bank or one brokerage, but by multiple banks and brokerage firms.
The credit markets can also affect housing. Brian Gendro of ING Investment Management says while the Fed may have lowered interest rates, banks are far less willing to extend credit to regular customers.
So in effect, what's happening is the credit markets are undoing the beneficial effects of the Fed easing. We may get sort of another downswing in the housing market if mortgages aren't available or if they're available only at rates that are not affordable.
He says the economy won't recover until lenders believe the housing market's problems are well and truly over. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
We got the minutes of the most recent Federal Reserve meeting this afternoon. There wasn't anything terribly newsworthy in there. The same cannot be said, though, for the nation's banking industry. Today, the Federal Deposit Insurance Agency warned of more bank failures. The FDIC says the number of banks on its trouble list is up, and bank earnings dropped 80% from a year ago. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
FDIC Chairman Sheila Barr couldn't put any positive spin on bank performance in the second quarter.
By any yardstick, it was another rough quarter for bank earnings. But these results were not unexpected. As the industry coped with financial market disruptions, the housing slump, worsening economic conditions, and the overall downturn.
Bank profits dropped from nearly $40 billion last year to only $5 billion. One reason, according to the Milken Institute's James Barth, banks are having to shore up their reserves to cover the growing number of problem loans.
As institutions try to set aside more funds to cover losses, that results in a decline in earnings.
But Jeff Davis with FTN Midwest Securities wonders whether regulators who require more of a capital cushion are getting a little too heavy-handed.
The worry among investors is that the regulators, in their effort to get ahead of this curve, they will make the situation worse by forcing banks to call loans and dump assets on the market.
Often, when banks call in bad loans, they have to put foreclosed properties up for sale. Selling such assets in the current down market, Davis says, only hurts banks' bottom lines. Adding to the industry woes, the growing number of bank failures is straining the insurance fund that covers deposits of less than $100,000. Chairman Barr says this October, the FDIC will consider raising the fees that banks pay to keep the FDIC insurance fund solvent. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, amid all that mixed news, the markets were mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Dieting and watching what you eat can be a challenge. There's nothing more boring than carrots for a snack when what you'd really like is a Snickers bar or something. So the state of Alabama is offering a stick to go with that carrot, a monthly chunk added to your health insurance bill if you don't at least try to trim down. From WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, Tanya Ott has the story.
Here's a number for you. Obesity costs the U.S. healthcare system $93 billion a year. But honestly, the number I wanted to know when I first heard about this policy was my body mass index. So I went to the web. My height is 5'2", and my weight is 164 pounds. We hit compute BMI, and the answer is 30. Under the new plan, state employees in Alabama who have a BMI of more than 34 and don't address their problems with cholesterol or blood pressure will have to pay $25 more a month for health insurance.
This is not really good public policy.
Alan Monheit is a health economist at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. He says several things determine someone's predisposition to being overweight, from how far they commute to genetics. But Eric Finkelstein, author of The Fattening of America, How the Economy Makes Us Fat, thinks genetics are overblown. He says for many people, the issue is behavior.
I think the question that people need to ask is, are we better off with a strategy that may discriminate against some subset of individuals, but that on net may substantially improve the health and the financial health of the country? And I think that's really what this law boils down to.
Finkelstein says it's no different than private health insurance, where rates are based on risk. Alabama will spend more than $1.5 million on medical screenings and health education the first year of the program. I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
If that story leaves you curious about your body mass index, we've got a calculator, or a link to one anyway, on our website. It's marketplace.org. By all indicators, $4 a gallon was about the point where American drivers cried uncle. More of us are riding bikes to work or taking mass transit. 65 is the preset on cruise control for some instead of 75 or 80. And it works. Gasoline demand has been down a couple of percent for the past several months. But for all the talk about smaller, more fuel-efficient models, it's taken a while for Detroit to catch up to the rest of us. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the big three automakers are just now taking some simple steps to improve the mileage of the cars they sell.
Lou King is the general manager of a Ford dealership in suburban Washington, D.C. When customers walk into her showroom, gas mileage is on their mind. And gas prices are only part of the reason.
Social trend as well. I think that people want to be viewed as green.
But for Ford, GM, and Chrysler, that's not easy. Mike Quincy follows the industry for Consumer Reports.
For the past 15 years, the American public has wanted to buy big trucks.
The big three delivered, investing billions in plants that build gas guzzlers. Quincy says retooling the industry will take years. So in the meantime, GM, Ford, and Chrysler are tweaking their existing models. They're changing tires, adjusting transmissions and exhaust valves in hopes of getting one or maybe two more miles per gallon. Sam Weingarten runs engine engineering at GM.
You know, some of those kind of things can be rolled out pretty quickly.
But Weingarten says some other changes in the works, like building big engines that burn less gas, take longer. But you have to wonder, why'd they wait so long to do the little stuff? Quincy from Consumer Reports says there's no good answer, but changing course in the auto industry has always been tough.
It's like a huge aircraft carrier. It doesn't stop on a dime. It doesn't turn on a dime.
And it burns lots of gas. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
I'm kind of hoping you're tuning in the car on the way home right now, because what you're about to hear might explain a lot of what's going on around you. The guy in the next lane who's not merging even though there is clearly a lane closed ahead. Or why traffic lights never seem to be lined up green in the direction you happen to be going. The thing to remember is that when you're on the road, it's not really about you, the single driver. It's about the rest of us. That's one of the points Tom Vanderbilt makes in his new book, Traffic. Tom, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
The thought that was going through my mind the whole time I was reading this book was, man, he can't be talking about me. I'm a great driver. And I bet everybody else had the same thought, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, studies show that 90% of us, in when these surveys are done, say they're average or better than average driver, which, you know, I didn't go to MIT or anything, but mathematically sounds a little bit dodgy.
Well, it's tricky, right? Because basically what I want when I drive is to get where I'm going as fast as I can in one piece. But that is not always, you say, the best thing for everybody else on the road.
Even congestion and jams, you're often finding large groups of drivers just driving into those jams at pretty high speeds, which leads to not only rear-end crashes, but sort of worsens the jams. And there's a thought that if you could just make drivers approach at a slower, steadier pace, it would be quicker to get out of that congestion. And so in England, on the M25 motorway, for example, they have something called variable speed limits, which the computer sensors are alerted that there is a jam developing, and a new speed limit is sent back upstream, as the engineers call it, for the drivers to respond to. So it's a slower and steadier approach rather than just basically driving into a big pack of congestion.
One of the points you make, Tom, is that driving, you know, for as utilitarian as it is, it's just flat hard, right?
In one study, they found that driving at 30 miles an hour, you were exposed to 1,300 pieces of information per minute. So driving is incredibly complicated, and we find ways to sort of make it more so by introducing texting and cell phones into our cars when, you know, if you really think about the actual act of driving, it's quite intensive.
So here's the question I bet everybody is going to want to know the answer to out of this interview, which is, why is it that there will be a fender bender and it takes the traffic from that minor incident an hour and a half to clear?
Engineers have various rules of thumb on this, but things like 1 minute of an incident will create 4 minutes of congestion. And if you think about traffic as sort of water flowing into a bucket, and imagine there's a hole at the bottom of that bucket that's a certain size, that's your bottleneck. You might sort of widen that bottleneck over time, but it's still going to take a while for all that water to drain out, and you're still adding new water. So you're either sort of driving into the back of that jam as it's dissipating, or the jam is growing toward you. And, you know, when a two-lane highway has one lane blocked, that's a 50% reduction in capacity.
So why do we drive the way we do?
Well, you know, we are all individuals. We have our own view through that windshield that kind of warps our perspective, I think. And it's hard for us to imagine the traffic system as a whole, and engineers sometimes have to work with technologies and strategies to fight our individual impulses. Like in Los Angeles, for example, the classic case is ramp meters, those little traffic lights at the end of on-ramps that keep you from going on when it looks like the highway is moving fine. So people are wondering, why are you not letting me on the highway? It's flowing fine. And the engineers say, the reason it's flowing fine is because we're not letting you on the highway. And just that tension between the individual and the system, and what's good for one is not often good for the other.
Well, what do the traffic engineers tell you when you go and chit-chat with them and spend time with them? Do they know that they're banging their head against the wall and they're dealing with a crafty, crafty enemy in the American driver who's going to find a way around whatever they decide to do?
Undoubtedly. I mean, the best example of this was a paper I saw presented at one traffic conference, and the person had a disclaimer after coming up with this whole model for improved traffic flow. He said, "This model does not account for the heterogeneity of driver behavior." And that's a quite polite way to say that, you know, everyone sort of does what they want and we can't predict that.
And so fundamentally, there's nothing that's going to get me home faster.
No. Telecommuting. Telecommuting, personal jetpacks, and all
right.
The stuff that popular science was promising us back in the 50s.
All that good stuff. The book by Tom Vanderbilt is called Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. Tom, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, nobody ever said building cities in a hurry would be easy.
I've gone to a construction site before where Even the supervisor really doesn't read the drawings.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials moved up 0.25% today, 26 points to close at 11,412. The NASDAQ gave back 0.1%, 3 points to finish down at 2361. The S&P 500 rose 0.33%, 4 points to end the day at 1271. Crude oil bubbled up to $116 and change today, which means airlines flew into a strong headwind. United Airlines lost an unfriendly 8%. Delta and U.S. Airways each nosedived more than 5% today. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac both posted strong sessions. Shares of Freddie jumped more than 20%. Fannie added more than 8% today. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 3.78%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its durable goods report for July. The red carpet is rolled out in Italy for the 65th Venice International Film Festival. The world's oldest film fest opens with a screening of the Coen brothers' latest, Burn After Reading. And if you can't get tickets to that, there's another touristy activity in Buñol, Spain, La Tomatina, the annual tomato-throwing festival. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hillary Clinton's going to be the headliner tonight at the Democratic National Convention. She and other speakers taking the podium can be expected to hammer the Republicans on the economy. While the convention's on, we've asked Democratic policy junkies to tell us about an issue they think the party's neglecting. Today, commentator Will Marshall says Democrats are short one plank in their energy platform.
Party platforms aren't exactly beach reading, but they do tee up the critical choices voters will face in this fall's presidential election. The Democrats, for instance, devote big chunks of their platform to energy security and climate change. Now, they rightly blast the Bush-Cheney policies that have turned a blind eye to science and made our country more dependent than ever on fossil fuels. And they spell out a smart, clean energy alternative. But there's a missing element in the party's platform, and that's any discussion of the future of nuclear energy. In fact, nuclear power doesn't rate a single mention in 57 pages. That doesn't make a lot of sense, especially in a document that calls man-made climate change the greatest threat to our planet. If that's true, and most scientists believe it is, shouldn't we be expanding nuclear energy instead of ignoring it? Nuclear energy has a huge advantage over coal. It's climate-friendly. It doesn't pump any carbon dioxide into the Earth's atmosphere. And it generates loads of power, almost 20% of America's electricity needs. Nuclear energy is no panacea. It's expensive and it generates a lot of waste we haven't figured out how to get rid of yet. And Democrats are absolutely right that our country needs to invest big time in clean and renewable fuels. But in the near term, there just isn't going to be enough solar, wind, hydro, or geothermal power to keep the lights on in our offices and factories and to heat our homes in the winter. If we don't expand nuclear energy, we'll have to turn to coal and gas to meet America's growing appetite for electricity. That's an inconvenient truth for environmentalists whose hostility to nuclear power hasn't changed since the Three Mile Island incident back in 1979. Other countries aren't so superstitious. China has plans to build dozens of new nuclear plants, and France already gets 80% of its electricity from atomic energy. So it's time for U.S. progressives and Democrats to break the taboo on nuclear energy. What better way to show we're serious about protecting our planet?
Will Marshall is president and founder of the Progressive Policy Institute. That's a think tank affiliated with the Democratic Leadership Council. If there are issues you aren't hearing enough about, tell us. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We're going to start letters this week with a weather report. The National Weather Service said today Hurricane Gustav could be a Category 3 storm by the time it enters the Gulf of Mexico this weekend. There aren't any predictions yet as to where it's going to make landfall, but you can bet they'll be keeping a close eye out in New Orleans. The Crescent City has struggled to rebuild in 3 years since Hurricane Katrina left its mark. Last week, Tess Vigeland was here telling us about her trip to New Orleans earlier this summer and how there's still no real rebuilding happening in the areas hardest hit by the flooding. Jeannie Sadler from Sacramento, California, said that should be taken as a sign that the residents are wisely relocating to higher ground.
This story could have been reported as a city moving forward and upward with an eye towards the future instead of seeing a failure to recreate a catastrophe.
I interviewed Dr. Ross McKinney from Duke University a week or so ago about a particular kind of failure, the failure of the drug Vioxx, which Merck pulled from the market 4 years ago. Dr. McKinney and I were talking about a clinical study of Vioxx that Merck did, where the research was at least partly done for marketing purposes. New Jersey resident Peter Larson works for a pharmaceutical company. He says a report like that one should be taken in stride.
One should not forget that without the pharmaceutical industry, the thousands of life-saving therapies that are currently extending not only the lives, but quality of lives of millions of people worldwide would not be available.
We told you last week about a new standardized college entrance exam for 8th graders. It's the latest offering by one of the big testing companies, the College Board, which already markets the SAT and the PSAT. David Rigby thought we'd all be better off if we focus less on testing.
How about some learning? Our children need to learn to think, not just regurgitate facts on a test.
Last Wednesday, we aired an interview I did with Hugh Grant. He's the chairman and CEO of Monsanto. We talked a lot about the company's main moneymaker, genetically modified seeds.
12 years, a billion plus acres of these crops been planted around the world, and absolutely no problems.
Chris Knight from Santa Clara, California, had a response to industries that claimed that kind of record.
12 years and absolutely no problems? I wonder if they said the same about lead, asbestos, or cigarettes. Unfortunately, the logic is fallacious. The lack of a problem doesn't indicate that the product is safe.
One more thing about Hugh Grant. You can tell he wasn't born here, right?
12 years, a billion plus acres of these crops been planted around the world, and absolutely no problems.
I called that on the air a Scottish brogue. I'm told it's more accurately a burr. Brogues belong to the Irish, I guess. One other correction for you. Last Friday, in a report about how the rich live, we mentioned an unusual gift wrapping idea. Lobbyist and former advisor to the president, Edwina Rogers, wraps her presents in sheets of cash. Should you be looking to do the same, we gave the wrong source for the supplier of the pricey paper. It's the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. If you don't care for the way we package something, let us know. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Now that the Olympics are done, life in Beijing can get back to normal. Even though you'd think that after 7 straight years of getting ready for the Games, all the construction would be done, that's not the case. Buildings are still going up all over China. That means a lot of opportunities for international architecture firms, like the ones that designed the Bird's Nest and the Water Cube. Big budgets and cheap labor are fueling the growth, but with all the opportunity comes a bit of risk. Lisa Chow reports now from Beijing.
Okay, so here are some of the problems for architects working in China. Sometimes you get plaster when you wanted stucco because you're working in translation. Chinese contractors may use lower grades of glass and stone without your knowing to save money. And cheap migrant labor has its drawbacks.
You have people who just showed up and found a job and they're working, but they don't have a lot of experience.
Jason Anderson is an architect in Beijing.
And there's not a lot of people here to teach them, really. You know, they just you get handed some tools and told to do something.
Anderson works for the New York firm Stephen Hall Architects. He walks me through the firm's first project to be completed in China. It's one of the most talked about residential complexes going up in Beijing right now, with 750 super luxurious apartments, a movie theater, and school. The towers of the complex are linked by bridges at the top floors.
The first bridge has a gym. The second bridge, that has a swimming pool in it?
Yeah, a suspended swimming pool, weighing about 800 tons. And that's the challenge, achieving world-class architecture in a country that's still developing. Silas Chow is China director for the Chicago-based firm SOM. He says Chinese contractors don't always appreciate architects' meticulous attention to detail.
I have gone to a construction site before where even the supervisor really doesn't read the drawings. That's why in China, a lot of these buildings are almost like a trial and error situation when you're building them.
The architects do think the buildings are safe, but they say the time pressure to get stuff done in China does affect quality and aesthetics.
What took Manhattan about 120 years to build? China is doing it for Beijing and for Shanghai. It's doing it in the last 20 years. So at that speed, there's going to definitely be mistakes.
China isn't the only place in the world where cities are being built overnight. Architect Gordon Gill has done a lot of work in China, but now he's turning his focus to places like Dubai and Abu Dhabi, where real estate is booming.
In the Middle East, the return for rentals and sales are tremendous, and things go very quickly. Buildings of 400 units will sell out in a day or two.
Gill says with this type of demand, the biggest risk in Dubai is also quality control. But so far, it has been a very financially rewarding environment for developers and architects.
It's kind of a rare case where in both China and the Middle East, you're having a huge influx of intellectual capital come into those places to make those cities and make those countries better. I think we'll look back over time and we'll see things that aren't quite so good, and we'll look back and see examples that have been set that really form the way that cities are made in the future.
And so when the money and opportunities are there, you take the good with the bad. In Beijing, I'm Lisa Chow for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, comment about the state of student loans a year or more into the credit crunch. The mayor of Akron, Ohio, has come up with what you can only describe as a creative way to fund student loans for city high schoolers. He wants to privatize the sewer system. It'll be on the ballot this November. The mayor says he can make $200 million by leasing the city's drain pipes to a private contractor and letting them run it. Not everybody, though, is wild about the idea of privatizing such a vital public asset. They're calling it, and I am not making this up, stools for schools. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow edged up 26 points, a quarter percent, 11,412. The number, the NASDAQ shaved off 3 points, a tenth percent, 2361 at the close. The S&P 500 tacked on 4 points, about a third percent, 1271 there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, get out your swim gear, gang. We're headed to the pool to test the limits of underwater gadgets.
Standing in the 3.5-deep heated pool on a rooftop.
Not as bad as the audio booth, right?
A little embarrassing, perhaps.
Well, it's kind of fun, though. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.